Show of hands in the room. How many of you have ever heard of the name Potter Stewart? Potter Stewart. P-O-T-T-E-R, Stewart with a W. Not surprised. I'm not discouraged, but keeping in mind, you will know about him because you probably have heard something he has said that was attributed to him. So you may not know the name, but you'll know what he said. In 1964, in the United States Supreme Court, Justice Potter Stewart was hearing arguments on a case regarding obscenity in the case of Jacobellis versus Ohio. In explaining why the material at issue in the case of what was not obscene under the Roth test, and I have notes about that in my sermon that if you want to learn more about it, you can either Google it or you can look at the bottom of my notes when they're posted online. That this was not obscene under the Roth test and therefore was protected speech that could not be censored. Justice Stewart wrote the following: "I shall not today attempt further to define the kinds of material I understand to be embraced within the shorthand description of what is identified in this obscenity case as pornography. And perhaps I could never succeed in intelligibly doing so." In other words, defining it. But he says this: "I know it when I see it." Anybody ever heard that before? Then you know who Potter Stewart is. You just don't know him by name. "And the motion picture involved in this case is not that." So he couldn't define what it is specifically, but based on what he saw, he identified that that's not what it was. "I know it when I see it." A phrase still used today in just such a manner, unable to clearly define what something is or looks like, the fallback is when you see it, you can then define it. This goes along with another cliche: a picture is worth 1,000 words. So Stewart's "I know it when I see it" standard was praised as realistic and gallant and an example of candor. It was also critiqued as being potentially fallacious, meaning mistaken belief, due to individualistic arbitrariness. In other words, two people will see the same thing. One will see one thing, one will see the other. So individual or subjectiveness, so to speak. William Goldberg wrote this about Justice Potter and his statement: "The simple phrase embedded in the plurality opinion carries with it many of the conflicts and inconsistencies that continue to plague American obscenity law. In effect, I know it when I see it can still be paraphrased and unpacked as, I know it when I see it, and someone else will know it when they see it. But what they see and what they know may or may not be what I see." So again, subjectiveness. So his standards might be higher or lower than the other person. So this phrase can be seen as a rather subjective perspective to where two people may not arrive at the same conclusion. So why do I bring this up? There are plenty of terms being used today. Plenty of narrative that is attached to each term. But does the narrative fit the term? The term systemic racism has been brought up quite frequently, including last night by one of the candidates who identified it as an issue that needed to be addressed should his bid for the White House be successful. If successful, you will likely be hearing the term rather frequently. But do you have a point of reference? Do you understand what people are trying to convey based on this term Would you know it if you saw it? Systemic refers to something that is spread throughout, affecting a group or system, such as a body, an economy, a market, or society as a whole. When someone has stage 4 cancer, it is systemic in that it is spread throughout their body, basically. That is systemic. We are not talking about pockets, but rather that which is infused within the culture and reflective of the practices of government and the people. I want you to remember the definition. I will bring it to you at the end, but I want to make sure that you have a point of reference. So remember the definition of systemic racism. Tuesday and Wednesday, November 9th and 10th, will mark 82 years since Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass that occurred throughout Germany and Austria, 1938. We were unable to do our annual Yom HaShoah service this year, whereby we bring to memory the past and the Holocaust with the intention to never forget, and that so long as we continue to remember, we proclaim never again. Thus, rather than looking at what transpired and the totality of murder that had occurred during the entire Shoah, we go back to the infancy of this intentional genocidal extermination of a people. Such a focused effort towards the elimination of one people has not been seen since the days of Haman. Some may argue that there have been more numerous, yet within Europe, 78% of the European Jewish population was murdered, with the ultimate goal being 100%. We read in Esther, then Haman said to Ahasuerus, "There is a particular people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people. Moreover, they don't observe the king's laws. It doesn't befit the king to tolerate them. If it please the king, have a decree written for their destruction, and I will hand over 330 tons of silver to the officials in charge of the king's affairs to deposit in the royal treasury." This would be known as a quid pro quo, just to let you know, a term from last year. The king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hamdada, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, "The money is given to you and the people too, to do with as seems good to you." So how did Kristallnacht come to be? The chain of events started prior to this infamous date, November 9th, 1938, when in October, German authorities had expelled thousands of Jews of Polish citizenship living in Germany from the Reich. Herschel Greenspan, it doesn't look like it, but I believe it's Greenspan, 17 at the time, had received news that his parents' residence in Germany since 1911 were among those to be expelled. On the morning of November 7th, the Polish-German Herschel, 17, went to the German embassy in Paris and asked to speak to an embassy official. After he had learned of the deportation of his parents from Germany to the Polish frontier, Greenspan assassinated Ernst von Rath, the third secretary of the German embassy in Paris. He shot the 29-year-old von Rath 5 times, mortally wounding him with bullets of the spleen, the stomach, and the pancreas. The Nazis would use Greenspan's assassination of German diplomat Ernst von Rath on November 7th as a pretext to launch Kristallnacht, the anti-Semitic pogrom a violent riot aimed at the massacre or expulsion of an ethnic or religious group, in this case the Jewish people within Germany and Austria. Greenspan's parents and the other expelled Polish Jews were initially denied entry into their native Poland. They found themselves stranded in a refugee camp near the town of, this is going to be interesting, Bezin, I think it's pronounced, in the border region between Poland and Germany. So in other words, they were caught between a rock and a hard place, so to speak. Von Roth died on November 9th, 2 days after the shooting. The day happened to coincide with the anniversary of the 1923 Beer Hall Putsch. And I didn't look it up, but there's a link to it. An important date in the National Socialist calendar. The Nazi Party leadership assembled in Munich for the commemoration, chose to use the occasion as a pretext to launch a night of anti-Semitic excesses. Propaganda Minister Joseph Goebbels, a chief instigator of the Kristallnacht pogroms, suggested to the convened Nazi old guard that world Jewry had conspired to commit the assassination. The world, the Jewish world, conspired to assassinate this official in Paris. He announced that the Führer had decided that demonstrations should not be portrayed or organized by the party, but insofar as they erupt spontaneously. They are not to be hampered. I mean, there are things that have transpired over the last several months that you can, in essence, spontaneous protests out of nowhere. Yet they were planned. Goebbels' words appear to have been taken as a command for unleashing the violence. After his speech, the assembled regional party leaders issued instructions to their local offices. Violence began to erupt in various parts of the Reich throughout the late evening and early morning hours of November 9th and 10th. At 1:20 a.m. on November 10th, Reinhard Heydrich, in his capacity as head of the security police, sent an urgent telegram to headquarters and stations of the state police and the SA leaders in their various districts, which contained directives regarding the riots. SA and Hitler Youth units throughout Germany and its annexed territories engaged in the destruction of Jewish-owned homes and businesses. Members of many units wore civilian clothes to support the fiction that the disturbance were expressions of outraged public reaction. Despite the outward appearance of spontaneous violence and the local cast which the pogrom took on in various regions throughout the Reich, the central orders Heydrich relayed gave specific instruction. The spontaneous rioters were to take no measures endangering non-Jewish German life or property. They were not to subject foreigners, even Jewish foreigners, to violence. That is, non-Jewish foreigners, excuse me. And they were to remove all synagogue archives prior to vandalizing the synagogues and other properties of the Jewish communities, and to transfer that archival material to the SS. The orders also indicated that police officials should arrest as many Jews as local jails could hold, preferably young, healthy men. How were they able to be so precise in their targeting of only Jewish-owned businesses and properties? They were identified. Judah and the Star of David was written on the windows of buildings, of storefronts, where they could be easily identified. So how did they know? It was already determined in advance. So you have this identification who Jews are and who they aren't. So it wasn't that challenging. The riot has destroyed hundreds of synagogues and Jewish institutions throughout Germany, Austria, and the Sudetenland. Many synagogues burned throughout the night in full view of the public and the local firefighters, who had received orders to intervene only to prevent flames from spreading to nearby buildings, in other words, non-Jewish buildings. SA and Hitler Youth members across the country shattered the shop windows of an estimated 7,500 Jewish-owned commercial establishments and looted their wares. Jewish cemeteries became a particular object of desecration in many regions. The pogrom proved especially destructive in Berlin and Vienna, home to the two largest Jewish communities in the German Reich. Mobs of SA men roamed the streets, attacking Jews in their homes and forcing Jews that they encountered to perform acts of public humiliation. Although murder did not figure in to the central directives, Kristallnacht claimed many Jewish lives between November 9th and the 10th. The official figure of Jewish deaths released by German officials in the aftermath of Kristallnacht was 91. But recent scholarship suggests that there were hundreds of deaths, especially if one counts those who died of their injuries in the days and weeks that followed the pogrom. Police records of the period also document a high number of rapes and suicides in the aftermath of the violence. Here you see part of the results. A little hard to see. The images will be in my notes as well, so you'll have a better chance. But basically, this is a broken window of a Jewish establishment. And likewise, you have another establishments, whereby they're basically not only broken glass, but what you're going to see in a few moments is just a total destruction. One of the larger synagogues in total flames. We have another one. The roof is completely covered by smoke. It's hard to see. But basically, they're just standerbys, just watching. As the pogroms spread, units of the SS and the Gestapo, the secret state police, following Heydrich's instructions, arrested up to 30,000 Jewish males and transferred most of them from local prisons to Dachau, Buchenwald, and other concentration camps. Significantly, Kristallnacht marks the first instance in which the Nazi regime incarcerated Jews on a massive scale, simply on the basis of their ethnicity. Hundreds died in the camps as a result of the brutal treatment they endured. Most did obtain release over the next 3 months on the condition, that they begin the process of emigration from Germany. In other words, they were being kicked out. You can go free from these camps, but you have to leave. Indeed, the effects of Kristallnacht would serve as a spur to the emigration of Jews from Germany in the upcoming months. And here we see two images of them being rounded up, big Jewish star in front, men behind. And likewise, hundreds, if not thousands, of men being marched to likely cattle cars and shipped off to various concentration camps. So, in the immediate aftermath of the pogrom, many German leaders, like Hermann Göring, criticized the extensive material losses produced by the anti-Semitic riots, pointing out that if nothing were done to intervene, German insurance companies, not Jewish-owned businesses, would have to bear the cost of the damages. It's like, oh, it doesn't matter, but the ones who are going to be paying for it is us. Nevertheless, Goring and other top party leaders decided to use the opportunity to introduce measures to eliminate Jews and perceived Jewish influence from the German economic sphere. The German government made an immediate pronouncement that the Jews themselves were to blame for the pogrom and imposed a fine of 1 billion Reichmark, $400 million at the 1938 rate, on the German Jewish community. The Reich government confiscated all insurance payouts to Jews whose businesses and homes were looted or destroyed, leaving the Jewish owners personally responsible for the cost of all repairs. And here you have the aftermath. A little hard to see, but all that's left is the studs, so to speak, rubble all over the place. This is from the night of broken glass and the burning of synagogues. One would call that a total loss or total destruction. You could not repair that in any way, shape, or form. In the weeks that would follow, the German government promulgated dozens of laws and decrees designed specifically to deprive Jews of their property and the means of livelihood. Many of these laws enforce Aryanization, the transfer of Jewish-owned enterprises and property to Aryan ownership or German ownership, usually for a fraction of their true value. This is what is known as a forced transfer of wealth. Ensuing legislation barred Jews already ineligible for employment in the public sector from practicing most professions in the private sector. In other words, they couldn't work for the government, they couldn't work on their own. The legislation made further strides in removing Jews from public life. German education officials expelled Jewish children still attending German schools. German Jews lost their right to hold a driver's license or own an automobile. Legislation restricted access to public transport. Jews could no longer gain admittance to German theaters, movie cinemas, or concert halls. There was no internet whereby information of the events that had transpired were viewed instantaneously, but we did have the telegraph. News of the events did reach this side of the Atlantic. American newspapers across the country covered the Nazi assault on Jews in front page banner headlines and articles, and the events continued to appear for several weeks. No other story about the persecution of the Jews received such widespread and sustained attention from the American press at any other time in the Nazi era. In other words, this was the height of our understanding on this side, to where the Nazis warned Jews in U.S. to shut up. Don't overplay the hand, says Goebbels, as he alibis riots. The Jews are now fined. This was the $400 million, the 1 billion Reichmarks that were imposed. This is the Philadelphia Inquirer from 1938. The New York Times, not a bastion of Jewish support by any means. Nazis smash, loot, and burn Jewish shops and temples until Goebbels calls a halt. Keeping in mind, this is a perspective that was conveyed. Goebbels is the good person that helped the Jewish people, yet he was one of the masterminds behind it. And again, the New York Times record with regards to anti-Semitism is nothing to write home about, because they were complicit and complacent. And then ultimately, you have this headline from the Los Angeles Examiner in 1938. Nazis warn world Jews, we will be wiped out unless evacuated by democracies. Blatant right there. The Nazis will wipe out the Jewish population unless they're evacuated. Probably one of the starkest headlines that appeared during that time with regards to what was going on within the confines of the German land. The events of Kristallnacht represented one of the most important turning points in National Socialist or Nazi anti-Semitic policy. Historians have noted that after the pogrom, anti-Jewish policy was concentrated more and more concretely into the hands of the SS. Moreover, the passivity with which most German civilians responded to the violence signaled to the Nazi regime that the German public was prepared for even more radical measures. In other words, there was silence. So there was silence. So it's like, oh, well, nobody's paying attention. Nobody cares. Let's turn up the volume, so to speak. Appeasement and apathy of the public led to greater measures imposed on a single people. The Nazi regime expanded and radicalized measures aimed at removing Jews entirely from German economic and social life in the forthcoming years. The regime moved eventually towards policies of forced emigration and finally toward the realization of a Germany free of Jews. The deportation of the Jewish population ultimately to the East. Thus, Kristallnacht figures as an essential turning point in Nazi Germany's persecution of the Jews, which culminated in the attempt to annihilate the European Jews, in other words, all Jewish people within Europe. As a result of the events of Kristallnacht, the intention of the Nazi regime would intensify and thus come to develop a response to what is identified as the Jewish question. That response is known as the final solution. I've included a link providing greater understanding of what this purely evil plan against Adonai's people of the covenant is all about. So just reminding you of the definition, this is what systemic racism looks like. And it has a name in this case, and it's anti-Semitism. Every aspect of government focused solely on one people, one religion, one race. When you see a nation being non-responsive to the actions of the government directed towards a specific race, demographic, or religion, whereby the actions of the government, legislators, and leadership are directed towards one people solely because of who they are, this is racism. When these actions are upheld by the state or nation, this is systemic. We have seen it in our past as a nation, thus leading to a civil war. Such ideology still resides in pockets of our nation, but not throughout the nation. It is accurate to say that racism still exists. Yet it is not accurate to say that it resides throughout the nation, thus making it systemic. Remember, systemic refers to something that is spread throughout, affecting a group or a system, a body, a society. Thus, in order for this to never happen again to the Jewish people or any people, we must always remember, we must share this with the next generation and thus encourage them to share these details with the generation that follows them. The identification of specific people singled out because they are different is not new, but has occurred even before Kristallnacht. Not just because of a people only, but because of their laws, their way of life, being different to when they will not bow to the pressure of a ruling authority, whether government or a king. We have witnessed this defiance before in Daniel chapter 3, starting in verse 8. But then some Kasdim approached and began denouncing the Jews. They said to Nebuchadnezzar, the king, may the king live forever. Your Majesty, you have ordered that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, harp, zither, lute, bagpipe, and the rest of the musical instruments is to fall down and worship the gold statue. And that whoever does not fall down and worship is to be thrown into a blazing hot furnace. Verse 12, there are some Jews whom you have put in charge of the affairs of the province of Babel, basically Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these men, your majesty, have paid no attention to you. They do not serve your gods, and they do not worship the gold statue you set up. So we ultimately know the story of these three young men being put in the furnace to burn for their dishonor and disobedience of the king. Yet we also witness the presence of another king. In verse 23, these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the blazing furnace. Suddenly Nebuchadnezzar sprang to his feet. Alarmed, he asked his advisors, "Didn't we throw three men bound into the flames?" They answered the king, "Yes, of course, your majesty." But he exclaimed, "Look, I see four men, not tied up, walking around there in the furnace, unhurt. And the fourth looks like one of the gods." Small g, he uses. Nebuchadnezzar approached the opening of the blazing hot furnace and said to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, "You servants of El Elyon, come out and come here." Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego emerged from the flames. Doesn't say this in scripture, but they emerged unharmed. The king continues to reign and will ultimately come for his people and those aligned with his people. The very one who was in the flames because of three men who refused to worship another god, another system. They were identified. They were singled out, so to speak, because they would not conform. Their ways were different than the ways. But there is one that they honored, and the one that they honored protected them. So the king continues to reign and will ultimately come for his people and those aligned with his people. Revelation chapter 22, verse 6. Then he said to me, "These words are true and trustworthy. Adonai, God of the spirits of the prophets, sent his angel to show his servants the things that must happen soon. Look, I am coming very soon. Blessed is the person who obeys the words of the prophecy written in this book." So there is obedience required, but it's a question of who we are obedient to. Then I, Yochanan, the one hearing and seeing these things, when I heard and saw them, I fell down to worship at the feet of the angel, showing them to me. But he said to me, that is the angel, "Don't do that. I am only a fellow servant with you and your brothers, the prophets and the people who obey the words in this book. Worship God." Then he said to me, "Don't seal up the words of the prophecy in this book, because the time of their fulfilling is near. Whoever keeps acting wickedly, let him go on acting wickedly. Whoever is filthy, let him go on being made filthy. Also, whoever is righteous, let him go on doing what is righteous. And whoever is holy, let him go on being made holy." "Pay attention," says Yeshua. "I am coming soon. And my rewards are with me to give to each person according to what he has done. I am the Aleph and the Tav, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. How blessed are those who wash their robes so that they have the right to eat from the tree of life and go through the gates into the city. Outside are the homosexuals, those involved in the occult and with drugs, the sexually immoral, murderers, idol worshipers, and everyone who loves and practices falsehood. I, Yeshua, have sent my angel to give you this testimony for the Messianic community. I am the root and the offspring of David, the bright morning star. The spirit of the bride says, come. Let anyone who hears says, come. And let anyone who is thirsty come. Let anyone who wishes to take the water of life free of charge. I warn everyone hearing the words of the prophecy in this book that if anyone adds to them, God will add to him the plagues written in this book. And if anyone takes anything away from the words in the book of this prophecy, God will take away his share in the tree of life and the holy city as described in this book. The one who is testifying to these things says, yes, I am coming soon. Amen. Come, Lord Yeshua. May the grace of the Lord Yeshua be with all. So, there's a whole lot of evil in the world. We are witnesses of the good things, though. Today was to shed light on darkness. Because God's desire is for that never to happen again. Yet just as 99% of the German church was Lutheran, they were mostly silent. Just as the German government equated silence with a propensity to do more, our silence would be a complacency that God, I don't believe, would be happy with. So hopefully I've given you an idea of what systemic racism is. You saw the focus on one people and everything pointed towards them to make their life, pardon my French, a living hell. To eradicate them from the face of the earth, if not Germany by itself. We as a congregation are here to speak out against this. It's not a comfortable message, but it's not meant to be. It's meant to make you aware. It's meant to make you be observant. Because if you don't know what it is, then how can you respond to it? At least this way you have imagery and actions to where the idea, I know it when I'll see it, is not just something subjective. It's not an opinion. But here you have meat on the bone, so to speak, where you see the focal point of an entire governmental system. Think of it this way. Looney Tunes fans. They're trying to catch Bugs Bunny and he's in his hole. And you have this image of guns all around the hole so he can't escape. Anybody remember the cartoon? Yeah. That was the image of Germany towards the Jewish people. All guns were focused or aimed at them directly. Even though it's not Yom HaShoah, we continue to say never again. And in order for that to happen, we can never forget. So if everybody will please rise.